one into the night. Deep into right. Way out of here.
Swung on.
Bit crushed.
And the Phillies are going to lead it.
Harper, the swing of his life.
The 0-2 pitch. Swing and a miss. Struck him out.
From WHYY, welcome to your Friday edition of Hittin' Season, a Philadelphia Phillies podcast. I'm Justin Clue, I write for Baseball Prospectus, and I'm the author of Summer of the Cheap Wieners, what the 1941 Phillies were up to while Joe DiMaggio was making history. Available now. With me is Liz Rocher, the editor of Sabres Baseball Research Journal. Hello, Liz!
Hello, Justin. Baseball is definitely what everyone wants to talk about today.
Baseball on the brain. A city's gone crazy for it, Liz, I assume. I've checked in on the emotional level of Philadelphia sports fans, and I assume it's all about these Phillies in the second half and their below average play thus far. I can't imagine what else is possibly. Yes, the Sixers signed LeBron this morning for a two-year deal, and boy,
you said that out loud. Announcing that, and it doesn't sound real.
I mean, a lot of thoughts racing through my head here. Among them, has he played defense in the last 5 years? But also
no.
Among them, 16 years ago, I guess it was, I sat in an apartment in Brewerytown and watched The Decision and just, you know, you never think stuff like this is going to happen. He's 41 years old, folks. You're not getting LeBron in his prime. We're all aware of that. But at the same time, LeBron is LeBron, and he's going to wear a Sixers jersey in actual NBA basketball games for the Sixers. It's not dissimilar from Bryce Harper, honestly. Somebody who is wearing the face of the sport of the league they play in will now also be representing the Philadelphia team. It's crazy. It does feel crazy because you spend, you know, it probably has more to do with the age we came up in, where free agents just didn't come here, and the Philly teams just didn't seem to make big moves very often, certainly not the Phillies, but we all know Jim Thome changed all that, and now, hey, everybody's more excited for the arrival of a middle-aged dude in Philadelphia than since the last time the Phillies brought somebody up from AAA, you might say. So, very cool. Very cool that LeBron is here for, you know, regardless of the basketball playing aspect, but clearly also the thing people probably were going to want to talk about today. So,
I mean, it's hard not to be excited about it. And I'm just thinking about all the possibilities now we have with Harper and LeBron in the same city.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, they only intersect in like their sports playing a little bit. But it's still super cool. I can't imagine the level of pandering they're going to do. It's going to be epic, and I'm into it.
Yeah, I mean, they might find a way to get them in the same photograph or something. You know, You gotta think. You know, it's gonna happen.
I mean, someone pointed out on Blue Sky that there's no way that Harper isn't walking into CVP tonight in all LeBron stuff.
Yeah,
in all LeBron.
Obviously.
Yeah, I'm guessing his management has already called a t-shirt shop in Philly and was like, can you get this done in 2 hours?
This is, to use a basketball term, a layup for Harper.
Yes.
and his management team. Of course he's gonna come in with some LeBron stuff today, obviously.
I'm psyched, man. I can't wait.
It's just, you know, again, regardless of, you can find all the haters you want of the Sixers, of LeBron to the Sixers. They're not going to be Sixers fans. Not today. This is the one day where the move is just the move and the city explodes, which is why it's so funny to get this announcement like before noon or around noon on a Friday in the middle of the summer. Like, people are going to down the shore this weekend and like, it's going to be. I'm not going to say a disaster, but like people have ample time to celebrate this in as loudly as they want to. And, you know, they're certainly going to do that because that's the kind of news it is. Very, you know, well, the Phillies will have a chance to counter this in the trade deadline as we approach it in early August. But it's going to be tough, I would imagine, to match this energy.
I know. I mean, it's another example of a team going all in. You know, the Phillies did their all-in thing a few years ago, and that was when they got, like, Schwarber and Castellanos together in the same offseason. That felt really big That was, you know, that was them going all in along with, you know, all the other moves they'd made. And so it's nice to see, it's cool to see the Sixers doing the same thing and being like, all right, we've got almost everything we need. Maybe adding this guy will give us the last push to get Joel Embiid, one of the greatest players Philadelphia has ever seen, a championship. Or at least beyond the second round. My God.
A lot of great reactions to it. Somebody said, don't sell the Simmons Castellanos house to LeBron.
Oh, please don't.
Keep him away from that property. Maybe just tear the whole thing down, just to be safe. I feel like we've been through this enough times to recognize the pattern. That property doesn't need to exist. And then someone else suggested, hey, are we going to get LeBron in the booth with John Kruk? Also a realistic possibility,
I would have to say.
So, yeah, just a lot of everybody can see how this is going to play out in the next couple of weeks before any basketball is actually played, which is the safest time to celebrate a move like this.
This is the best time of a signing. I mean, when it finally starts, you have to face reality. But like, this was the best part of the Harper signing. You know, we had like a couple of months to really get into it for him to become, you know, dig into everything there is in the city. And now LeBron has like tons of time to come here and visit, lots of photos, lots of people. I'm psyched. This is going to be a wild few months.
And speaking of big acquisitions, Jim Salisbury said on the Phillies show that Byron Buxton apparently told a Phillies player last summer that he would waive his no trade clause to come here.
Ooh.
Yeah, silence. That's kind of the reaction there. That's fine. I mean, look, I'm pretty sure Byron Buxton, who is always hurt, is currently hurt. I think he has like a hip problem right now. This is the main thing about Byron Buxton. Like, you know, the numbers are always great. And you could even say, in some cases, elite level statistics from Byron Buxton and a player you generally want on your team. For anybody unfamiliar, the 32-year-old center fielder for the Twins was last year, you know, I remember the write-up being like, hey, the Twins could be really good. Their success entirely hinges on the ability of Carlos Correa, Royce Lewis, and Byron Buxton to stay on the field, which is a very heavy lifting sentence in the sense that those guys really have a hard time staying on the field. Correa, not even with the Twins anymore, hasn't played since May. And Byron Buxton also, I mean, he missed some time. He missed some time between like around the All-Star break, before and after the All-Star break. But he did play against Cleveland. So he is back on the field. But as anybody who follows baseball knows, Byron Buxton is just a tragedy in the sense that he cannot stay on the field. So that's like the first risk that comes to mind when you're thinking of like an acquisition like this. But and we'll get to this in a minute. But as far as like what the Phillies would have to give up for this level of trade, which is the level of trade that I personally feel like they are not equipped to make, they feel pretty confident, you know, that their prospects are valued across the board. And something like this maybe could be more of a reality than we've been saying it is. But I have very strong doubts, and like I'm kind of laying out here, an acquisition like Buxton, where, you know, the success relies on his ability to do something that, misfortune or not, he has just been not unable to do his entire career. Yeah, I mean, it comes with risks. But then again, Liz, what trade doesn't?
True. I mean, if this was the only move they made, not only, but if this was the major move they made, would you be happy with it? Regardless of whether or not Buxton's playing time, you know, notwithstanding.
You're asking me right now?
Yes, yes.
No, I think that I've actually come around from what we even said on the last hit and season roundtable, in that if this team doesn't feel like it can make a high-level offensive trade, then you might as well just invest in whatever pitching you can acquire. Like a feat of strength of the team, and you know, that's going to have, we were talking about ripple effects. I think that's going to have a bigger chance to have a ripple effect than an out, especially if Byron Buxton is the only guy you get, then you might lose him for weeks or the entire time. And, you know, maybe you get some great production from him and he does what he's there to do. He is a right-handed bat. So, you know, and so much more, obviously, with what he has been able to do in the past, but you know, He was last. He was an All-Star this year and last year and in 2022 for a reason. But at the end of the day, if that's the only thing you can do, I mean, this team has way more problems than one injury risk outfielder is going to solve.
Exactly. Yeah, I feel similarly, but I also feel like this might be definitely more of a reality than people think it is, because like it was last year that the Twins. No, yeah, it was. We got Johan Duran from the Twins, right? It mm-hmm. went through a massive sell-off. And so they're still in the we're looking for lottery tickets phase. And if there's one thing the Phillies have a lot of, it's got those types of guys. Guys that you don't know how they're going to work out, you know, that are still in the early stages. So if they're willing to part with some of those guys, then, I mean, I think this would be a decent trade to make in addition to other bullpen moves. But I wouldn't be unhappy with it. I would be unhappy with this alone. But, like, it's not a bad decision. It would just be better if it were with other players, with, you know, in concert with, you know, bullpen trades.
And to recontextualize the quote, remember, this was Jim Salisbury saying something that Buxton apparently told a Phillies player a year ago. So, just again.
But this is what we have to go on. This is it. They're not playing well right now, and so we are focusing on the trade deadline, of which there is not much. So we're going to make it all last, kids.
They're not playing well. They are not playing the worst, which is kind of a terrible place to be in as far as commentary goes. The Phillies have played 6 games since the All-Star break. They have lost 4 of them. They were 18-9 in June. They are 8-9 in July. So they already have the same win total from last month now. But when you say already, I mean, it's July 24th. So there's a chance they finish this month with a winning record. I mean, not a bad chance, you know. Obviously, they've still got the Yankees coming in. But, you know, this team can win baseball games. It's not like they just look like the worst team sometimes when they lose, but they are not the worst team. They've only been outscored 29-24 here in the second half, so they're not always losing outwardly, but they are losing stupidly, which is the problem. Yes. The old big three, the offensive big three from the first half, Liz, Kyle Schwarber, Bryce Harper, Brandon Marsh. Not what you would call the big three right now. Kyle Schwarber hitting 143. He's got 1 home run in the second half. Harper's hitting 190. He's got 1 home run in the second half with 3 RBI. Brandon Marsh hitting 143 in the second half. He's got the 1 home run and the 1 RBI, which is, yes, himself from that home run that he hit. but there is, Liz, a new big three in town in Trey Turner, who's hitting 375 with 4 home runs and 7 RBI since the start of the second half of the season. JT Realmuto, unthinkably, man who's the image of whom running back to second base will be living in our heads until the Phillies reach their next hot streak.
I saw that again this morning and was, I mean, it's hard to be. I was just so embarrassed yet again. And I'm embarrassed. I'm not even playing.
There were few. My softball season finally opened last night. There were fewer base running gaffes from middle-aged people shaking the rust off in that game than there were in the Phillies-Dodgers series, which is really saying something.
Great.
Realmuto, yeah, like I said, hitting 368 with 7 hits in 6 games. Well, he hasn't even started every game. So, you know, he's doing something. And that was before he was starting to like hit a little bit before then as well. Alec Bohm hitting 360, 2 homers, 6 RBI in the second half. Turner and Bohm have OPSs of 1,000 or more in the second half currently.
All right.
And like I said, Realmuto alternatively committed the dumbest base running blunder I've seen in a long time.
It's been a while.
I mean, watching him arrive safely at third and then being like, and yet the play ends with him being out at second is still just, it's flabbergasting. And we'll talk about it. We'll talk about it in a minute. We got some thoughts to share on that in a little bit, obviously. But I just want to talk more and just frame the Phillies as they stand after their first 2 series here after the All-Star break. As a team, they have 11 homers. That's the same number as the red-hot Red Sox have, who just won 15 games in a row. The Phillies are hit, but they are hitting 186 with runners in scoring position.
Good Lord. hard.
8 for 43. Only five teams are worse in that category, including the Mets, who are the worst, who are hitting 136 with runners in scoring position since the All-Star break. And the Phillies, you might recall, recently lost a series to the New York Mets. So what does that mean?
This feels like the Phillies we know. This feels like the post-All-Star break Phillies we know.
They are hitting fly balls. They've got a fly ball rate of 43.4%. That is top five in Major League Baseball. Really only good news if your fly balls are also going over the fence at a reasonable rate. And, I mean, hey, the good news there is that the frequency with which the Phillies fly balls are becoming home runs is 18.6%. That's also top five across baseball. You may recall, the Phillies have scored a lot of runs via the home run so far in the second half. So, you know, it's a good thing, but also you got to be scoring in different ways. And if you look at their line drive percentage, you can see the rallies aren't so much there as the big, you know, run scoring home runs are there. They are hitting the ball hard. As Fangraphs says, the Phillies have the third highest hard hit rate in baseball in the second half at 42.3%. And like I said, the line drive rate is bottom three. Their hitters are hitting line drives 14.7% of the time, down at the bottom of the league with the Blue Jays and the Royals. Whoa. They also have the second highest K percentage in the National League in July behind the Pirates at 25.9%. And they are 23rd in team OPS, which is .698, a sub-700 team OPS for the Philadelphia Phillies. So not great, kind of doing that slow, slumpy, sweaty offense thing that they just love to do.
They do.
Pitching wise, Wheeler and Lizardo have both made some great starts. Sanchez got knocked around a little bit again. Aaron Nola has given up 5 home runs in the second half already, but this isn't in his defense. It's just part of the constant contextualizing you have to do with Nola. He is also the only one who's made more than one start so far. So as we know, the fifth spot in the rotation is just a real quandary. Bullpen-wise, Shugart, Meza, and Kirkering have been pretty messy so far in the second half. Duran saved one of the Phillies' wins after Shugart tried real hard to lose it. Duran made a scoreless appearance in that 6-1 loss to New York. Jose Alvarado has faced 10 batters. He has not allowed a walk or a run and only allowed one hit. So keep that under your hat, because that'd be great if that could continue, but we're not at the point where we're ready to talk about that yet. Guess let's just keep letting it happen silently so we don't scare it off.
No one's noticing or looking at it.
So, Liz, after all that, how are you feeling about the Phillies in the second half so far? 2 series down, 2 big opponents. Yes, the Mets are a lot worse than anybody thought they were going to be at this point when they were talking about this post-All-Star game gauntlet the Phillies were going to have to face opponent-wise, but they still took care of business against the Phillies, and anytime you play the Mets, it feels like a big game. And then, of course, the Dodgers came to town, and, you know, yikes there. Do these numbers demoralize you? Do you think they're actually part of a bigger downward turn for these Phillies? Or are you with Don Mattingly, who said to NBC Sports Philly, if we play well, we're capable of beating anybody?
I mean, more than one thing can be true.
No, they can't. That's actually a common misconception. One truth, that's it. That's all you get.
I mean, John Mattingly's right. When they play well, they can beat anybody. That's true of pretty much any team. So it's true, but not entirely convincing. Then again, you were saying all those unpleasant stats, and I was remembering to myself, it is just 6 games. It's just 6 games, 2 series, and while neither of them were pleasant, there's still a lot more to go. Of course, we're rapidly moving toward August. I think universally known as the worst month of both the year, or at least the worst month of the summer and of the baseball season. There's nothing happening. Everyone's tired. It's warm and humid. There's rain. There's more rain usually. You know, no one is thrilled. No one is happy to be playing in August. So you want them to come into August better than this. Because, I mean, I have memories of previous seasons where they took enormous nosedives in August. Or maybe that was September. It's hard to tell. Those last 2 months do kind of roll into each other, don't they?
Well, Well, sometimes it's part of a slow decline that you look back and realize started in like June, and other times it's just a cluster of undesirable moments that happen in, yeah, later in the season in like August and September. You never know. You never know, and it's not inevitable. This team, I think, is perfectly capable of making this into just like, you know, a couple of lousy series. Yeah, where they made some mistakes and didn't come through. I mean, this team is going to keep making mistakes. Like, and that's, well, we're going to talk about the Dodgers series now. We might as well. Like, that Dodgers series seemed to generally kind of turn in the ninth inning of game number two, I feel. Like, no loss is one man's entire fault. You know, it's to the point where do you even need to say that out loud? But that doesn't change the fact that JT Realmuto becomes the face of that loss for obvious reasons. Think about the ninth inning of game two against the Dodgers. Alec Bohm, he leads off with a single. It's his third hit of the game. Yay! You know, hey, they're down by a run. It's 2-1. They're down by a run. They're at home. And then Edmundo Sosa, who, you know, when you talk about no loss is one man's entire fault, his at-bat going to get overlooked because of the scope of Realmuto's blunder, but Sosa followed Bohm with an at-bat that looked like he never even intended to be competitive. He took hacks at three pitches and then just went back and sat down. That was all over in like 90 seconds. That was a terrible follow-up at-bat.
He's taken a couple of real bad non-competitive at-bats, and I'm wondering what's up. I mean, maybe it's because maybe it's because he's being switched into a game late, and it's kind of, I mean, I don't know. It's just, I don't like to see it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to look up the numbers here, but somebody pointed out recently that one thing this Philly season has missed is like the month of Edmundo Sosa going nuts, filling in for somebody and just going off. Like, he seems to just have a couple of weeks every season where people are like, we need to make him a starter. And yeah, I'm looking at his game log, and I don't think we've really gotten that yet. Not in a prolonged sense.
I wonder how it compares, and one of us should have looked this up. We can't do it right now. But I wonder how it looks this season from last season, how many games he's played. Because usually, like last season, he had to fill in for Trey Turner for a while, right? Or something like that. Yep. And we got his crazy 3 weeks during that. If he's not playing consistently, this is what's going to happen. He's one of those guys that's better when he plays for like a full week and then, you know, takes a number of at bats at the end of games. Like, he has to play consistently sometimes to get a rhythm. And I think, you know, he's had a hard time doing that this season because he hasn't had to play. There hasn't been the need for him to play consistently. And so I at least want to make the point of that.
Yep. And then, you know, when a guy's not in sync, maybe, and again, Sosa is, he'll come up there looking like he wants to take the big swing and get the big hit. Like, it's a very Bryce Harper type of behavior, but he's prone to that, whether he's going well or not. But your point is valid that, yeah, more consistent playing time is always going to make a player more comfortable. And I also don't want to downplay Sosa's value to this team over the past few years. Like, I don't want to look at his numbers now and be like, this guy. He has been such a massive success in the role that he plays. Like, getting a hot month out of a guy who plays a utility role on your bench, that's great. That's a success story. Just a hot month. Like, that's fine, especially when he's filling in for a starter. That's fantastic. But unfortunately, in this particular case, this is one of those at-bats where it was not good looking. He was never close. You knew he was going to swing at that third pitch, whether it was a strike or not. It very much was not, and he struck out. So the Phillies had a man on first in the ninth inning of game two with one out now, and that's when Realmuto blasts a double to left. Yay! Yeah. And with Justin Crawford pinch running for Bohm, I thought for a second they might have tied the game right there. But they held Crawford at third, so they had two runners in scoring position with less than two outs. I'll admit it, Liz, in a one-run game at home in the ninth after the victory, the 10-7 victory from the day before, I started logging this as a win. I did. I thought they're going to win this game. Blasting the Dodgers in game one, sneaking a win past them in game two. I felt great. I really did. I thought, this is a setup for a win. All they need is to get the ball out of the, and yes, I'm aware of the runners and scoring position numbers I just read. I know reputationally and anecdotally what the Phillies do with runners in scoring position, but it just felt like, the vibes were there.
It seemed so easy for them to do at that moment. Like, this, they do that what they were supposed to do all the time.
I try not to lock in still unresolved outcomes as, you know, outcomes. But in this particular case, I was like, oh yeah, nice. They are going to win this game. They've got, you know, they got two hits already in the ninth with less than two outs. It just felt like, yeah, they're cruising. They got this. But unfortunately, that's not what happened, Liz, as you might recall, with Real Muto on second and Justin Crawford on third. Brandon Marsh, after a lengthy discussion with Kyle Schwarber, which again led me to believe like, okay, Marsh has been struggling lately, but Schwarber's like getting in his ear here and being like, all right, like this is, you know, this is the plan. This is what you want to do. He goes up there. He doinks one off the end of his bat. Crawford is breaking for home. He's running on contact. He's a dead duck. Third baseman gets him immediately, like targets him immediately. Mm-hmm. So as that's going on, Brandon Marsh runs through the bag at first. He does not go to second for some reason. No. But even less sensically, JT Realmuto arrives safely at third, then decides Justin Crawford has a shot at getting out of this pickle and takes off back to second. And Mookie Betts, with the noise of like a carnival arcade machine going off in his head, confused and delighted, tags Justin Crawford out easily, and then also easily nails Realmuto at second for a double play that ends the game. Now, everybody makes mistakes, and I feel like there was an awful lot of, hey, you know, we all have brain farts on the job that came out of this, despite how frustrated everyone was in the moment. That's fine. I'm talking about softball season opening. I currently lead my softball league in brain farts. I can guarantee you that. So it's not like it's an unrelatable thing to do. However, JT Realmuto is supposed to be your field general out there. Him particularly goofing up in this regard really irks me. He shakes his head at disgust at, like, you know, Jared Hughes sprinting in from the pen. He takes his, you know, personal health very seriously. He's a serious guy. We all said he'd excel at pitch challenges because of his instincts and his experience coming into this year. And I'm not even saying we're wrong about that. I'm just saying that's the reputation he has. And then afterwards, after this moment where everyone was like, what are you doing? He just kind of gave like a, yeah, I made a mistake. It was a bad base running error. And it's like, yeah, okay, own it. But also, this is really annoying. You know, he's got some opinions I don't share, but on the ball field, I trust him to do his job. And yeah, he's not the same offensive player he used to be either. But you still, again, he is a guy who's supposed to, you know, have it all aligned, and, you know, it all makes sense to him. He can see the numbers and the space and time coming together to create each moment of a baseball game. He is, like I said, the field general. So this bothered me. He literally ran them out of a comeback win with nothing but a stupid, very bad-looking mistake. And even Don Mattingly said, for the most part, I don't know what JT was thinking there. Then he told us later, I thought Justin Crawford was going to get out of that pickle. Again, not something that makes total sense. Not something that really makes any sense, especially with a guy with his instincts and experience. But here we are. It's what happened. And you know, yikes. So were you particularly annoyed at this because, A, it cost the Phillies what seemed like was going to be a very exciting and earned win, or because it was JT Realmuto specifically?
I mean, that it was JT specifically is always irksome, but I'll say also that it's a brain fart, but this is entirely his fault, because how often has he been on base this season to even pull off a play like that? He's barely been on base. He was hitting like 200 at some point not long before the All-Star break. Not good. And so if he had been even a little bit better this season, those instincts about base running, his own base running, might not have been so freaking rusty.
His on-base percentage for the season is sub 300. So, you know, I don't think anybody's shocked to learn that. He's hitting 219 right now. As I said, you can't rely on JT as a productive bat in your lineup anymore. That's kind of been accepted quietly along the way, despite, as I said, him being one of their top hitters at the moment in this small sample size that makes up the second half right now. But like I said, yeah, he's certainly not an on-base machine. But again, putting that aside, he's just supposed to know. But that leads to him, you know, grounding out, striking out, not moving a runner, not coming through in a big moment. You know, you're used to seeing that at this point. This was like going out of his way to do something cartoonishly inexplicable that completely befuddled everyone with eyeballs who was watching. There is not an excuse. All you can do is just go like, okay, well, I guess don't do that again. I don't know how you could, but like, you know, don't do that again and let's try to move on.
Yeah. Like you, the image of him at second base with his hand outstretched, he's just like crouched to the ground. I can't stop seeing it. It's just so pathetic. It's so sad. I kind of think we need like a separate classification for errors like this, because it's not an error. This was someone forgetting how to play baseball, sort of.
Well, the like, word there's a, they always a
Trey
use
Turner
is
error
gaff.
Where he, yeah.
So there should be that's, gaffes for base running
yes,
errors.
Like, Trey Turner, like, you know, juggling a ball or missing something that slips by his glove or whatever, an error. You know, that's an error. That's a, you know, that's what that is. But this was, I mean, gaff, I guess, is the best word, but is there something more extreme than that? Like, there, words fail me. The Germans might have a word for it.
Well, that's the thing. Words failed everybody in that moment. So that, I feel like, was the turning point of the series after the Phillies won 10-7 in game one and then looked to be on the way to a walk-off victory in game two. And then that Real Muto play just kind of ended that. You know, I mentioned a Don Mattingly quote at the end there. That's another question I wanted to ask you. Don Mattingly, how's he doing? I mean, I think at this point, the grace period is over. The early, you know, surge from the managerial change has wrapped up. And, you know, if the Phillies do get hot again, it will be a separate hot streak rather than the one that occurred as soon as Donnie Mattingly took over. There are plenty of questions about his bullpen management right now. There are questions about him leaving starters in too long or sending them back out after a rough inning, Aaron Nola being the most clear and recent example to that. Going to unfavorable matchups, sending the wrong guy to the plate at the wrong time. Part of it is what's at his disposal, Liz, but, you know, sending Aaron Nola out for another inning after he got into trouble at the end of the last one is more or less, for anybody who's got familiarity with the Phillies, kind of just asking to lose. Like, you're asking for trouble. Like, you're not saying this for any kind of personal insult or everybody. It's just sort of the objective truth at this point. You just accept that, like, look, when Aaron Nola doesn't have it, you can tell he doesn't have it. And leaving him in the game, you're doing so at your own peril. Aaron Nola does not typically bounce back from getting into trouble. Once he starts to give up runs in a game, that's kind of all she wrote.
Gone.
Yeah. So sending him back out is just like, hey, man, I know you've been watching this team. Like, this is, you didn't just get here when you were the manager. You were here before you were made the manager. I know you've been watching. Like, what is this decision about? So this is, it's part of an ongoing trend, and you're starting to see criticisms of him pop up. And I don't think there's any reason to assume Don Mattingly will definitely be the manager next year. He's still the interim manager. I believe that's still part of his title. So I don't know. I mean, where are you at with Mattingly?
I mean, I think I'm kind of not meh, but so. I mean, he's been doing well, but there are some obvious areas he should improve on as Phillies manager specifically. And what we're seeing are tendencies that he showed in Miami. And I think some of that has to do with his time in Miami, because maybe there was one year that he had like a good team to work with that was doing well. And so he's used to being able to leave his starters in, because are you going to lose? Probably. You're the Marlins. So, I mean, he needs to get out of that habit and look around him and sort of absorb what the Phillies and their lineup are telling him. Until he does that, he's going to be so, because it is frustrating to see lessons that you should learn by now. Lessons that I bet Aaron Nola could tell you that you should learn by now that he isn't learning. So I will say that if the option is Mattingly versus Alex Cora, the answer is going to be Mattingly all day long.
you're going to be watching people assume that Alex Cora will be the next manager of the Phillies for some portion of the winter. Whether it does or doesn't happen, that's going to be the headline for a while. People are going to be, if it becomes like formal that Mattingly won't be the manager, I'm not saying that I know anything, I don't, but if that were to happen, the first thing you're going to see is the likelihood of Alex Cora and everybody writing about that and talking about that. And I'm not looking forward to that conversation. I wasn't looking forward to game three after the way game two ended. The next day, nobody involved in that final play was starting, which I thought was interesting. Brandon Marsh was not starting. Justin Crawford was not starting. JT Realmuto was not starting. I don't think that's, punishment. I don't think you could classify as that.
No.
Especially not, Crawford was pinch running like that. He wasn't making any kind of long-term mistake there, but still, the Phillies lost that game 2-9-5. They were up 2-0 early after an Alec Boehm bomb, and they also tied the game back up at 3-3 in the fifth. So looking competitive, but
feeling so hopeful.
Yeah, ultimately just got flattened by what you can only conclude is a superior team right now. Yep. Certainly a deeper team, which I do think makes the Dodgers the superior team to the Phillies, and I don't think you're going to get a whole lot of people arguing against that, Liz.
Yeah, I don't think so either. You don't want to say it because you want the Phillies to be as good as they can be, but they fell flat on their face. The Dodgers didn't make any big mistakes like that. They just didn't. And that's one of the big differences. Like, if Realmuto hadn't done such a stupid thing, we'd be in a different place and be talking about this differently, even if they had still lost game three. So that one little mistake really changes your opinion of how you look at the whole team.
Yeah, I mean, and it's partially because this isn't the first time we've seen these guys, in this era, really do any like this is very normal. It feels like this is part of their reputation, essentially. And then in game three as well, Bryson Stott had a base running blunder as well. And he ran on contact and was tagged out. Like, that's, again. And you saw a lot of commentary after this series about how, the Dodgers did a lot of little things right. And the Phillies don't, they don't really do the little things right. And you can find plenty of old school writers talking about, how that's true. And then it's very important. The Brewers have a great reputation for doing the little things right, as in, hitting the cutoff man, etc. And when the Phillies get sloppy, I just feel like the Phillies have a larger capacity for sloppiness than these other contending teams. Obviously, I think Mattingly's right. When they play well, they can beat anybody. I think that's true. But, when they play well is, again, doing some heavy lifting in that sentence that, they may not be playing well at any given time. And they certainly weren't playing well against the Dodgers. And the thing about the Realmuto play that really sticks out, and then the Stott play to a lesser extent, but still in the same category, is that it feels like it's not so much that they're doing little things wrong. It's that they're going out of way to do big wrong things.
That we all notice and that make a huge impact.
Yes.
I will say, that's something I never consider when I think about the Brewers and them always being an quote unquote unexpected contender, despite being, good the year before. They don't have a ton of big name players, but they do all the small things right. And you have to wonder, if they're this good without, a ton of star players, those little things might actually matter a whole lot.
Yep. And certainly in the playoffs, that's when little things matter the most. So you want to hope, all you can do is just hope that stuff like this is out of their system by the time the games are playoff games. But you really can't say that for sure. You just gotta, hey, just be smarter, guys. Be smarter, be better. Please. That's just, at least don't do that. Let's upgrade to not doing.
LeBron's a Sixer now. We can't embarrass ourselves in front of him. Come on, guys. He's here and he's watching.
Well, you mentioned LeBron, so we can talk about acquisitions potentially for the Phillies in the coming weeks. Again, we are still about 2 weeks away from the August 3rd MLB trade deadline. Gotta assume the Phillies will do something. The hot stove isn't really crackling at the moment yet, so there's nobody really feeling super motivated to start making wheels and deals at the moment, but Matt Gelb has a great and thorough write-up the Phillies farm system. So if you have any questions about who exactly is down there and who exactly could be traded, he has a great breakdown of the different tiers of players that the Phillies have in their farm system. Some names you probably haven't heard and you can get familiar with, even if they are potentially gone soon. But in general, the Phillies farm system may be ranked 29th by Baseball America and in the bottom 10 by other rival scouts. But the Phillies, Gelb writes, see their farm system as more middle of the pack. You'll be surprised to learn.
I'm shocked.
They also, apparently they also think Zach Wheeler's just going to change his mind about retiring at the end of his deal, according to a different report. But the Phillies think a lot of things.
Yeah,
so,
he seems like the type of guy who's just going to change his mind, huh?
Mm-hmm. Scott Lauber's recent article asked if the Phillies had the farm system to make the trades they want, which has been my big question for the past couple weeks. And unfortunately, it didn't really conclude anything. The article gave Dave Dombrowski and Preston Mattingly the space to say they didn't think their farm system was that bad. And I believe there was a player development specialist quoted in there, too. Fangraphs and MLB Pipeline both have it ranked as 24th and 20th, for what that's worth. That's kind of it's not great. It's not good. But, like, the scope of anywhere from 20th to 29th is different from being universally picked last. I will just
Absolutely.
At least say that. There is a difference. But Lauber does
have a
conclude...
a lot of prospects that you can look at in different ways. And at least that's kind of encouraging.
Lauber does conclude, even so, it's fair to wonder if there's enough for in the Phillies minor league stable to make meaningful additions to any area of the major league roster. That is the question. With the addendum that Dave Dombrowski has made a career out of using mid-farm systems to create World Series teams, so that's why you should be unsurprised to hear his quote to Ken Rosenthal of The Athletic, "There is plenty of interest in players in our system. That's not a concern at all." Liz, is that a concern at all?
I think it might be a concern if Baseball America is ranking you 29th, though like you said, it is encouraging that 24th and 20th are in play. But yeah, I hope he's right. He's had a lot of opportunities to make trades, to make big trades for pieces, and I don't know that he's done it more than maybe once or twice. So let's see if he can hit, once or maybe more than once this offseason. It would be nice if he's right and that, remember, these aren't teams ranking farm systems. These are outside entities. And so it is true that it could be true that other teams value the Phillies farm system differently than outside entities. And if it sounds like I'm rationalizing, that's because I am.
Yeah. And that's... people are going to have the perspective they're going to have. And Dave Dombrowski's, I think just intrinsically going to have a rosier view of the farm system he has to deal with, especially at a time where he
of
wants
course,
people
yeah.
to think it's appealing so he can make trades with the players within it. But I also don't think he's lying. And maybe I'm a rube, but I don't think he's lying when he says that there's more interest in players in their system than anybody on the peripheral is going to be able to see or know about. And that's obvious. You don't have to look at these players down in like high A or in the Florida State League and look at their stats and be like, well, nobody wants this guy. You don't know what other teams are looking at when they look at your players. There may be somebody that, that executive is deeply attached to and watching their whole career, and he wound up on the Phillies and he still wants to get him. But even putting like specific exceptions like that aside, there are there's ceilings and potentials and arm movements and outputs that scouts look for that you're not looking for or you're not seeing or you don't care about, and that's perfectly understandable. But other teams are going to look at that and see value. That's the important part. And the Phillies, as Dave Dombrowski says, have players that other teams are interested in. So this was kind of a boost. I don't think this is the difference between the Phillies like making a trade for Tarek Skubal or a back of the rotation starter, but it's more like you can feel confident that the Phillies are going to get something effective done because you don't have to keep asking, are they equipped for this? I think there is enough to address one or two of these issues effectively. I'm being conservative about that because I still don't think being ranked 20th at the highest means you have, you know, an endless list of assets to be sent out there. Yeah. But I do think you should feel comfortable thinking maybe some of these issues can be solved. They're probably just not going to be solved with the names people have been desperate for, you know, like Byron Buxton or something. So just a note, just an interesting quote from Dabrowski I wanted to make sure we got on the record. But one of the more concerning things, and the farm system being low-ranked feeds into this, is also the Phillies' depth issues. They did finally promote Brian De La Cruz from AAA. He had a homer in that 9-5 loss that finished up the Dodgers series, but De La Cruz is merely a Band-Aid on the oozing wound that is this team's numbers versus lefties. Todd Zielecki informs us the Phils entered Wednesday ranked 24th in Major League Baseball with a 683 OPS against lefties. Their right-handed hitters ranked 29th with a 638 OPS against them. Now, you can survive on that because, as we've talked about, you know, probable pitchers for each weekend series on the Friday show, you don't really notice a high number of lefties getting the start against the Phillies. But as the second half gets later and later and the playoffs get closer and closer, then the playoffs are here and the Phillies are presumably in them, you are going to see much more of teams trying to take advantage of this very clear vulnerability with the Phillies as they start throwing almost nothing but lefties at the Phillies. As Zielecki writes, these numbers would be the worst mark by any Phillies team since 1969 when they hit 627, when they had a 627 OPS against lefties. Yes. Zielecki continues, expect to hear the Phillies connected to and scouting every available right-handed hitting outfielder on the market in the coming days. Think everybody, from Taylor Ward to Lane Thomas to Joe Adell to Helio Ramos and more. They would love to get Harrison Bader 2.0, which, yes, made me sit up and say, you know, Harrison Bader 1.0 was right there and
yes!
You let him go. But
did anybody
the counterargument to that
constantly
is
constantly saying that during the offseason.
Unfortunately, Liz, you do have to now point out that Harrison Bader was hitting 170 for the Giants after 30 games and he hasn't played since late May. So,
listen,
Harrison Bader 2.0 is the ideal. Yes.
Harrison Bader 1.0 was great, and if he had not gone to the Giants, a clearly cursed team, and stayed here, I believe things would have been different. But now we'll never know. Thanks, Dave Dabrowski.
Never know. Now we're on the hunt for the same success we got from a guy who was already here. Depth. It'd be great to have some. I don't know if you've heard, but Rafael Marchand left a game with a knee thing, and that Garrett Stubbs is already kind of already a little unavailable. He's battling a wrist issue that it was reported that the Phillies are just hoping it will heal between his sporadic appearances. That famous Phillies catching depth is even thinner than before. Phillies Nation is throwing names out there like Paul McIntosh and Peyton Henry, and that's how you know might be time to get a catcher of the future somewhere. I'm not even saying at the trade deadline, like we don't have to worry about this year's trade deadline is more about, hey, what's going to happen in the next few weeks? What's going to happen at catcher is a different question that I think needs to be addressed with more time and a more comprehensive overview of the farm system and part of a general overall strategy for the future of the Philadelphia Phillies. But moments like this remind you, yeah, that's a very razor-thin position organizationally, and you only need to lose one guy or not even lose one guy to be able to point at that and say, like, huh, it's JT Realmuto, you know, did the big dumb thing that we were talking about earlier at the top, and then some guys who, if they get hurt, you're kind of in it. So this presents another challenge for the Phillies. We will again have to see how things get addressed. Like I said, I don't think this is necessarily on their radar as some kind of big fix for the upcoming trade deadline, but just another indication that this team has some great players, and below that first layer of great players, there's not a whole lot going on. And that's one of the differences.
Nothing.
That's one of the differences you saw between this team and the Dodgers in that series, is that the Dodgers always have another guy. The Phillies just don't.
I will say, I still think Shea Langeliers is a great fit. He is a catcher and I believe has some years of team control left. Or if not, I think they should just sign him. They need a catcher, and they're not going to find him below the majors. They're just not. They have to find like an actual major league ready catcher in the next, like, I don't know, 18 months or less.
Yeah, I honestly at one point thought that this issue would have been addressed maybe last year, maybe the year before, but the Phillies have not prioritized this, and they've put a lot of faith in JT Realmuto. So, you know,
yikes.
We'll see. But before we wrap up, I do want to get to some local news. Did you hear about some thieving that's been going on? According to NBC 10, a guy in the Philadelphia area has stolen 10 pairs of North Face shorts worth a total value of $880, 50 Philadelphia Phillies jerseys worth a total value of $6,549.50, Nike women's apparel valued at $1,751.96, which he stole while wearing one of the Phillies jerseys that was stolen from the Dick's Sporting Goods at the Franklin Mall the previous evening.
Oh, God, I've been to that Dick's Sporting Goods.
Police apparently spotted his vehicle. They tried to pull him over, but he didn't slow down and got away. So, guess they didn't think he had a gas pedal. Another theft occurred at a Lululemon with this guy as the suspect. He was discovered in the same car with a pair of accomplices, but they released him pending further investigation. They did tow his car, however, and then a week later got a warrant to get into the car, which they found stuff related to the thefts. And then, and again, I believe I was reading the story correctly, it is only then that this guy and an accomplice again stole 54 Phillies jerseys worth a total of $7,073.46 from the Dick's Sporting Goods at the Franklin Mall again.
Oh, my God.
According to the story, in all, this guy and his accomplices stole over $16,000 in merchandise from these stores. I think what we conclude, Liz, from this story is that the Phillies shouldn't wear their City Connects anymore.
Nope. They should not. And I think that is a great lesson to take away from this. If they do not get a new City Connect design, that's the only thing that's going to stop them from wearing these jerseys. That's it. They're going to wear these jerseys forever until they have a new design. So let's get on it. Whoever is in charge of that. I'm guessing they're listening.
Hat tip to security at the Dick's Sporting Goods in the Franklin Mall, by the way. I'm not blaming you. I'm like it's a hat tip. Like, hey, tough week. Tough week.
Exactly. We're sorry.
It's the Yankees at Citizens Bank Park this weekend as the post-All-Star Game gauntlet continues. On Friday at 6:45, it'll be the Yankees' Will Warren taking on Jesus Luzardo. On Saturday, the Phillies get a look at that stud, Cam Schlitter of the New York Yankees. He'll make the start on this Saturday evening game at 6:05. Phillies have yet to announce their starter for that game. Get that famous fifth guy. Wonder who it is now. Wonder which face he will wear.
I wonder.
But then on Sunday, the Phillies are back in primetime on the Sunday night game on Peacock with Ryan Weathers of the Yankees, a lefty, facing Christopher Sanchez. So you'll get to watch the Phillies on Sunday night again. And by the way, Friday Night Baseball, they're also on, so it's an Apple TV game. You'll have a lot of fun explaining to other people where to find the game tonight, whether it's a relative over the phone or a bartender in a loud bar. Get ready, to have to explain that. Another one of those fun weekends for Phillies broadcasts. But, Liz, any final thoughts here on the Phillies' second half, first two series, about to face the Yankees at home?
LeBron James.
LeBron James is in Philadelphia.
That's what I got.
Probably what the actual, the podcast you're probably listening to right now is probably about LeBron James. I'm going
to
guess.
The podcast you're listening to right now is screaming LeBron James over and over and over for 45 minutes. And it's most listened to podcast in the city.
While we were talking, somebody said that they announced over the public address system in an Acme that the Sixers had signed LeBron James. And somebody else said they were on Temple campus and a kid in a Sixers jersey was just announcing the news like Paul Revere as he walks through campus.
Someone on Blue Sky lives across the street from a church and a funeral was just getting out. And as they were watching this happen, he could hear the news passing in waves and people getting excited about it. At the end of a funeral. And I'm like, there is no other city like Philadelphia. That's the public address, the loudspeaker at an Acme.
Mm-hmm. Attention shoppers. And that's why
LeBron James.
That's why these moments are fun, because you get to see all the little ways that Philadelphia is different from everywhere else. So that's going to be a lot of fun in the weeks ahead as the city celebrates signing LeBron James, which still feels
that's a sentence you said.
Ridiculous. It's real. Yeah. Well, that'll do it for this episode of Hittin' Season. Thanks to my co-host, Liz Rocher. You can get new episodes of Hittin' Season 3 times a week anywhere you get your podcasts. You can also find bonus Phillies podcasts at the Hittin' Season Patreon at patreon.com/hittin'season. I'm Justin Clue, and from WHYY, that's the ball game. We'll talk to you next time on Hittin' Season.